Welcome to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. We've all heard about the Bechdel test for women in film.
And then we've ratcheted that up a little bit, and we've been seeing if films are passing what we've been sort of calling the agency test. Do the female characters have agency? Are they driving the story? Are they active rather than reactive?
But how far do women still have to go in Hollywood? Just ask Lily Tomlin.
You know, this is about moving the whole species forward, not just half of it.
Lily Tomlin and Zoe Elton of the Mill Valley Film Festival. Ladies leading Hollywood, that's our inflection point. The movie business is an industry that thrives on conformity, formulas, and stereotypes. It's rare to find an actress who is rewarded for doing her own thing. Our guest, Lily Tomlin, has done just that, not only in movies, but on television, on the stage, and on her own albums. By simply being herself, and a bunch of other characters like Ernestine and Edith Ann, Lily Tomlin has shown us what it means to pave your own way. She currently stars with Jane Fonda in the Netflix original series Grace and Frankie, and now she plays a grandma in the new Paul White's film, Grandma. In Grandma, Lily Tomlin's character Elle is a self-described misanthrope whose granddaughter Sage shows up one day out of the blue.
I need some help, Grandma.
Okay.
I need $600, $630.
For what?
I'm pregnant.
Who is he? A one-night stand?
No, ew. He's kind of my boyfriend.
Yo. Why didn't you use a condom? Or for humanity's sake, get a vasectomy?
Look, who is this?
My grandma.
We spoke with Lily Tomlin and the director Paul Weitz at a hotel in San Francisco. Lily Tomlin and Paul Weitz, welcome to Inflection Point.
Thank you.
The movie Grandma, at its heart, is about mothers and daughters and how they deal with and avoid one another. Lily, I read that Paul wrote the script with you in mind, and I was wondering, what was your reaction when you first saw it?
Well, I was a bit daunted. I loved working with him on admission. And so he asked me to just have coffee or something like that, and then he told me, and I thought, oh God, what if I don't like it? It'd be just so painful because I like him so much.
I felt a little bit like the guy who can't take a hint and keeps on asking the girl out for a date. It wasn't coffee. I remember, well, it was lunch and you ordered a steak salad, and I hadn't told her I'd written something for her, and I thought, oh, I hope she doesn't choke on her steak salad.
Really? Did I order a steak salad?
You ordered a steak salad, Lily.
I'd be darned.
Oh, so he surprised you. You didn't have to think ahead of time what you would say if you didn't like it. You had to, on the spot, worry about that.
Yeah, I choke myself and drop over on the floor. It turned out it was a lovely script, and it was an important script. So, and I felt very fortunate.
Thank you. And I think you've almost come to the point where you're going to agree to be in it.
Right.
now that it's out.
I'm assuming that you did agree to be in it.
I did.
We did see you there. Well, Paul, let's just cut to the chase on one of the things that the plot revolves around, which is that the character Sage is trying to get an abortion. Why did you decide to do that? It's such a controversial issue.
Yes, and we should say that Lily is not playing the character Sage.
Right, let's be clear.
It's a 18-year-old girl. This is just what occurred to me when I sat down with a notebook, was this situation of an 18-year-old girl showing up at her grandmother's house wanting to get dough because she's pregnant, and she knows that she doesn't have the wherewithal to bring up a kid, and she's doesn't want to wait one more day. She's scheduled a procedure at the end of the day. I won't say what happens, but basically, she asked her grandmother for money. Lily's character has only recently gotten out of debt and cut up her credit cards and made a wind chime out of them. Essentially, the two of them, Lily doesn't have the dough, but the two of them end up on this sort of little odyssey road trip journey where what's really happening is Lily is teaching this 18-year-old how to stand up for herself and educating her about the large swathes of women's history, which have somehow been forgotten over the last 20 years. And also, formidably, played by Marcia Gay Harden, they end up going to the one person who they're having to deal with, the one person they're both intimidated by, which is Lily's daughter and Sage's mother.
Well, at the beginning of the film, we learn that Lily's character is gay and has been in a long-time relationship.
while we're starting to see slightly more gay men portrayed on the screen, this is unique in leading ladies. Why did you make that choice for this movie?
Honestly, it's just how the character occurred to me. I had just spent some time with Lily on Admission, where she played Tina Fey's mom, and it was so clear to me that it was such a shame that Lily wasn't driving a movie that she was in every scene of. She's so smart and so edgy, and she's the exact thing that one wants in somebody that you admire, which is she's accurately cynical about human nature, but she also is very kind and caring about people. And the character, when it occurred to me, the character happened to be gay. Sage's character was pregnant. The character happened to be in her 70s. Really, though, the heart and soul of the humor and poignancy in the character is coming from some perception I had of Lily.
Well, Lily, we're sitting here in San Francisco, practically the birthplace of gay marriage. So I have to ask, I'm obligated, really. You recently married your longtime partner and collaborator, Jane Wagner. Why did you decide, after so long, to tie the knot?
Well, we'd always sort of viewed the concept of marriage, you know, fairly cynically. First of all, it was not open to us. And we just didn't want to kind of imitate the heterosexual community, which it seemed to be a bit of. And then we decided at the last minute, once it was passed, and Jane, I was asked constantly on the red carpet when I was going to get married, and I'd just sort of say, oh, we'll get married sometime, we haven't decided, and all that stuff. And
then, you're getting to know each other.
Yeah. Yeah, after 44 years. So this one fellow, young fellow who just pestered me, he was very sweet about it and funny, but he would say, are you going to get married this year? You think you're going to get married? Are you going to get married? When are you going to get married? So finally I said, well, we're thinking about it. So then he just leapt on me. Every time I go on the red carpet, he'd bring it up. And so we just said, maybe we should get married. You know, it'd be fun. It'd be nice. We have the right to get married. It might mean something to other people who want to get married. And so we went out to Van Nuys and got our license, and then we had a girlfriend who's a lawyer marry us. It was all very lighthearted and fun.
But you were harassed into doing it.
No, then I knew I'd get that monkey off my back.
Exactly. Could ask you some other questions next time he
sees
you.
Yeah, right.
A review of Grandma in The Guardian calls you a hilarious crank. I don't know if you read that one, but do you read the film reviews that come out about you?
Well, this one I do, and this one we've gotten so many good reviews,
right.
and I, of course, I care about the movie, so I'm eager to know that it's being well received, and that people might be encouraged to go see it. So yes, I do read them. I don't read them for myself so much. I mean, of course, I do, but I read it for the overall movie, and I'm always interested in the project and how important it is, or, you know, and if it's just a flat-out comedy that I've done many of, I'm interested in that because I want the women in it to be viable. And I'm certainly never the first credit. I'm always a co-star, you know, with Bette or Steve Martin or any number of people. So I'm interested in the project. And this project I was really interested in because I thought it was brave and daring and edgy, and I just thought Paul was inspired.
Well, and you're really driving the film.
Well,
literally.
That's true.
That's right. You're driving that big old car.
Right.
Well, Paul White's, the relationships in the film really rang true for me as a woman with a mother and daughters. And I was just wondering how you, as a man, knew how to portray women's relationships so well.
Well, the writer who drove me to get really excited about writing was the playwright Chekhov, whose plays are largely focusing on women, whether it be Three Sisters or Uncle Vanya. It was really high time. I mean, when I did Admission, this is now the 10th film I've directed, and I began with American Pie, which oddly enough, my brother and I directed with my brother, we were actually trying to have that film be consciously not misogynistic, as one thinks that genre normally is. We were really aiming it towards girls as much as boys, and in that film, the girls are always put in positions of control. Nonetheless, I realized when I directed Admission that it was quite shameful that I hadn't done a film with a female protagonist. And Then when this one occurred to me, it just happened that every single character that had weight in it was female. And then there's a character played by Sam Elliott, who is sort of a ghost from Lily's past, who she has a very layered relationship with, who ended up playing a big part in the movie. But really, it's a female-driven movie. And, you know, when somebody asked me that, like, how did I come up with these female characters, like, I feel like I'm so inarticulate about it that it's almost as if somebody ghostwrote it or something. And the odd thing was, while I did spring it on Lily, the character was ghostwritten by Lily in that I was hearing her voice. And then when I brought it to her, my audience for this movie really was Lily, meaning if there was something there that she thought was fake or not smart enough, I would have yanked it out. And we had months to sit together and chew over things and sometimes just shoot the breeze and put in anecdotes that Lily might tell me. And it was a lot of fun, and also it made me feel like it was okay that this character was going to be the version of this that was going to please Lily.
Well, Betty Friedan of the Feminine Mystique makes a literary appearance in the movie. It's become very trendy for women and men to say that they are feminists.
Is it trendy now, within the last 6 months or something?
It's like you see it all over social media. I'm a feminist. I'm not a feminist. What does being a feminist mean to you?
I think, in many ways, I just think it's being a humanist and, you know, caring about the species, and that's it. And in fact, in the old days, we used to say, you know, this is about moving the whole species forward, not just half of it. And I totally believe that. I was just vigilant and sharp-tongued and sharp-eyed for that whole thing. I thought, you don't understand. This is for you. This is for all of us. You know, but people don't all cotton to that.
Well, what do you say to someone who says they're not a feminist? I believe in women's equality, but I'm not a feminist. I feel like I hear that a lot.
Well, I don't think I can make them a feminist. They might become a feminist, or maybe they have really feminist ideas and they don't even know it. So it's just a matter of how the world comes out. How's it all going to come together, you know? And I'm more concerned about, although I think it totally ties into feminism and it would be the correct thing to believe in or to pursue, but I'm concerned about just the survival of the planet, you know, and all the other, the factions in the world and the cruelty. And so I'm more concerned about that as an overview. And I always think, boy, it would be a big help if everybody was more feministly inclined.
Fair enough. What about you, Paul?
Well, one of the things that I was really thinking about in this movie, and I'm happy that there's been somewhat of a of an embrace of the term feminism. And I think you can look at sort of Emma Watson's speech at the UN as part of what's maybe turning the tide on that in terms of a younger person advocating that term. But there was, I think, about 20 years in which people didn't want to be considered feminists, and the term feminazi was probably more in vogue on college campuses. And Julia's character, the 18-year-old, is suffering the consequences of the forgetting of women's history. And there's a moment in the film which is very key to me, which is one where Lily's character has traded these very erudite insults with Judy Greer's character, who's your younger girlfriend in the movie. And then Sage, the 18-year-old, says, well, my friends just call each other bitch, hoe, and slut. And Lily's character says, well, what kind of friends are these? And I don't want to hear you use that word anymore. And we can really see how this girl, this 18-year-old, doesn't have the vocabulary and to stick up for herself, and that's part of what she's being taught.
We're talking with Lily Tomlin and Paul Weitz. Their new film is Grandma. You're listening to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. Later in the show, we'll speak with the program director of the Mill Valley Film Festival, focusing this year on contributions from women on both sides of the camera. I'm Lauren Schiller. We'll be back right after this. Hi, I'm Lauren Schiller, and I hope you're enjoying Inflection Point. You can show us how much you like us by going to our Facebook page at facebook.com/inflectionpointradio or follow me on Twitter at LA Schiller. Plus, sign up for weekly email updates at inflectionpointradio.org. Welcome back to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. My guests are Lily Tomlin and the director, Paul Weitz.
Well, Lily, let's go back in time to college. Right. I read that you left a major in pre-med
yes.
To pursue acting. both acts, I would say, of great going against the tide. Well, there probably weren't a lot of female pre-med at the time, but there also weren't a lot of female comedians at the time.
There weren't.
What gave you the confidence to switch gears and go for that?
Well, I got into a college show, and everybody who was a drama major would come out when I go and do an improv. I was playing one of the capitalist women in the Mad Woman of Chaillot, and I would have to lead an improv down a big circular staircase that where the capitalists were supposed to be banished to the netherworld of the Mad Woman. And I would just improv every night, and all the kids would run out in rehearsal. And one girl in particular, Iris Gorin, I always wondered where she is and hoping she'd get in touch with me. She kind of looked like Streisand a little bit. Iris would say, so intently, she'd say, do you know what kind of concentration you have? And of course, I didn't have any idea what she even meant.
What did she mean?
Well, just as an actor, concentration is supposed to be your complete focus on the role. You're living from the inside out. That's how I guess I would define it. It's just that you're in no way distracted. You're just living, and even if you're living, if you're standing aside and watching yourself, you're watching it with full intent. And so that meant a lot to me at that time. I thought, boy, maybe I should go to New York. I did a little bit on the show, and I was a huge hit because it was relevant. It was about a Grosse Pointe matron. And Grosse Pointe was a very rich suburb of Detroit. The Fords lived there and all that stuff. Yeah, so then I went to New York to try to be an actress. I thought, well, gosh, I do this kind of stuff just naturally in conversation, you know, characterize something. So I did eventually become an actress.
Well, do you think women who have fame and a megaphone as a result of their success have a responsibility to keep opening doors for other women?
You know, I hesitate to pigeonhole someone in that regard. I mean, it would be nice if they did. I don't want them to feel obligated to do it. If they don't do it naturally, it's not going to work very well anyway. And plus, people get very involved in their own careers, and it's hard to initiate a lot of help. Now, surprisingly, my good friend Jane Fonda has done a fair amount of that. I've really been pleased with her, more pleased than with myself. And she, you know, she's just done a lot of stuff. I see old pictures of her, you know, in some old beat-up coat out with Tom Hayden. And her little boy, Troy, is like, six or 7 years old. And anyway, she's remarkable.
Well, Paul, you're a guy. Do you believe that men in the industry should take a more active role in equalizing the industry?
Yeah, I do. The shameful thing is that there's a disparity between male and female directors in terms of how many people get to direct films, which needs to be evened out. I don't know why that is exactly, if there's still the remnant of some concept of some guy strutting around in jodhpurs and pointing at the megaphone.
That's not what you wear when you're
under my jeans, yeah. No, and also I think that whole thing is a myth because really the joy of directing is in collaborating and then giving over control to actors. But yeah, I have an 11-year-old daughter, but even without that, I would hope that I would be equally want to erase the disparity in the culture.
Lily, it seems like many of your major successes were ones you created for yourself or that you and Jane Wagner developed together. And I was just thinking that ownership is part of what makes you so unique. Was there a point in your career where you made a decision, you know, I'm just going to be in charge of what I do?
Well, I'd had a spot on the Gary Moore show. He was making a comeback. And they fired me after three shows because I argued about the material just incessantly. And they would bring someone in to do it, and then they would quietly shelve it because it was just a foolish bit of stuff. So I was typing market research tapes after all hours of the night at the Plaza Hotel. And there was an older woman there who did it, and she said, do you know who Mildred is? And at this time I was about early 20s. She said, do you know who Mildred Natwick is? And I said, yes, I do. And she said, well, someday you're going to get Mildred's parts.
And okay, I don't know who Mildred Natwick is.
Well, she was a wonderful character actress, just wonderful. And she was much older than I was. I'm sure, but at that time she was in her 50s or 60s. I'm not sure. And so I said, I thought to myself, well, I can't wait till Mildred Natwick takes a dive. I've got to do something for myself. And I did material anyway. I always made up characters and would go to the improv and work and do them, you know. So that was just a natural evolution that I don't know what. Oh, I got on Laugh-In. Well, that was my big break. I got on Laugh-In, and I did the last 3 years of Laugh-In. And then I had offered to do specials. Then I did specials, and I wanted a series badly because I love the idea of a studio that you can play in all the time and invent new stuff. Every week you get to do new characters, and you have a whole staff and all the machinery of a network. And I did six specials. I never got a series because they were always just too off the wall. I remember talking to Dave Eisner. What's Eisner's name? Michael Eisner. I was on ABC at this time. I did four for CBS and two for ABC. And I was talking to him. I was saying, this is your chance. You can step out in front and you can say, if you think the show's that unusual, you just say, we would like to take a chance on new talent. We want to be, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And he saw no sense to that whatsoever. So I did six specials. I did two Broadway shows, and I got in the movies because of Altman. I mean, Altman would be the only person who would have put me in the movies when I was just coming off Laugh-In. And most people thought I was Ernestine, and we had the same agent. That didn't hurt.
And Hollywood. Well, but I would say,
yeah. So I created a lot of material for myself, yeah. And I used what I was fond of saying was, and you probably heard me say this. I said what kept me off the Match Game. I had an act. That's all that kept me off the Match Game when I was coming up. You know, I was on Laugh-In, but on hiatus, you don't make a red cent, and all the other kids would have to go on Match Game or some show like that.
Which was a game show of sorts.
Yeah, game show, and it was, and I would go out and go on the road, and I cultivated a whole other audience, working live, and my specials cultivated another audience.
So I mean, special seems like the perfect description
for you. Well, I used to see other kids working, and they'd be so brilliant. They'd be in an improv group, and I'd go backstage, and I'd say, you know, in that one act, one piece you did an essence, the essence of a culture type that was so fabulous, and they wouldn't even remember what they'd done. And I'd say, you've got to build a piece on that.
So my last question for both of you, start with Paul, is what's the best advice you've ever received about show business?
Well, I don't know if there's good advice, but a lot of my family was in show business, and they used to say, some years you buy the jewelry, some years you sell it.
Lily, what about you? Best advice about being in show business that you've ever received?
Guess, I always hark to Bob Altman saying to me, you know, giggle and give in. Just on a project, you know.
Was he serious?
He would say it, yeah. I was talking to him one day about an editor that I was working with that was giving me such a hard time about an edit, you know, edits and stuff, and saying, oh, it can't be done. And I'd say, give me the footage, I'll make the edit work. And sure enough, I could, because I know myself so well, my performance. I know right where the syllable could be cut or anything. Anyway, so he would kind of blow me off about, he'd say, just giggle and give in. So I don't want you to judge him by that comment. But what solidified my passion for Paul is his mother was a great actress. You know, Susan Conner. I suppose, did he tell you that?
Well, no, she started a film called Imitation of Life that she was nominated for an Academy Award. And that's my secret weapon in terms of wooing Lily to do the project.
I was so excited because I'd already committed to the project, but my mother took me to see Imitation of Life in the late 50s. It's a Lana Turner movie. And Susan was a young girl, really. And she played a mixed-race girl whose mother was Juanita Moore, who just died recently. And Susan was just like out of this world. But my mother was so excited about seeing this movie. She said, I'm so looking forward to seeing this. She said, it's supposed to just be a killer. And she opens her purse and she had three washcloths in it.
For crying?
For crying. Yeah, so I was so happy to be able to tell Paul that story, and then I was able to tell Susan.
It was lovely.
I love it.
So
your advice would be?
My advice, I have no advice for anyone.
But definitely not giggle and give in.
Give in.
That's anti-advice.
Well, some instances, I don't think it's such a bad idea, because you might have a much bigger battle ahead.
Paul Weitz and Lily Tomlin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for having me with my current gender.
Yes. You're welcome back anytime.
Thanks.
I'm Lauren Schiller, and you're listening to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. Coming up, we'll talk with Zoe Elton, the program director for the Mill Valley Film Festival, focusing this year on the contributions from women on both sides of the camera. Hi, I'm Lauren Schiller. If you're liking what you hear, help us make more episodes. You can find our teeny tiny little donate button at inflectionpointradio.org. Just scroll down to the bottom of the page, click the donate button, and fill out the simple form. If you've got bigger aspirations and would like to underwrite our show, we would love to talk to you. In that case, you can just email me directly at lauren@inflectionpointradio.org. Thank you. Welcome back to Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. Even though at least half of moviegoers are women, the multi-billion-dollar business is still a bit of a boys' club. And it's not because women aren't interested in the biz. About half of film school graduates are women, yet only 7% of directors, 13% of writers, and 20% of producers are female. That's according to a 2013 study by Stacey Smith at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC. When it comes to acting, women only get 28.4% of speaking roles. And of those who do speak, their roles are highly stereotyped and not reflective of the progress women have actually made in the real world. The Gina Davis Center on Gender and Media claims that for nearly 60 years, gender inequality on screen has remained largely unchanged and unchecked. To make a dent in the problem this year, the Mill Valley Film Festival in California will focus a significant portion of their content on inspiring women in film. With us today is Zoe Elton, the director of programming. Welcome to Inflection Point, Zoe.
Thank you.
Why did you decide to focus on women in film for this year's film festival?
Well, I think you just nailed it. You know, I think that Stacey's study, she was attending the festival a couple of years ago, just lit some light bulbs in my brain. Because what I realized was that even though at a film festival like ours, we've been doing programming by and about women for many years, the numbers haven't changed. So I remember doing a panel 20 years ago and doing a little research before the days of Google on what the percentages were like, and they were very, very similar. So it really made me do some soul searching and say, well, if it hasn't changed in 20 years, why is that? And what are the action points? You know, what can we actually do to change it? So for me, as a film festival curator, I'm looking at what we can actually do. Part of that is obviously to show women's films. We've been doing that. But I think we have to ratchet up the conversation about film. We have to raise people's awareness about the way that they approach filmmaking and film storytelling, and, you know, raise awareness about who's making them and whose stories are being told.
Well, you're clearly on the screening circuit. You were at Cannes earlier this year. What are you seeing in terms of the trends of women in film? Do we have any signs of positivity out there?
I kind of like that you bring up the Cannes Film Festival, because it's a festival that's come under fire a lot in recent years for having very few women directors in the main competition. So it's a festival that's divided into three or four sections that are public, as well as a big market that is not so public for the industry. But in the main competition, the percentages of women filmmakers have been pretty tiny. Last year, they tried to make amends a little bit by having 50% of the jury be women. Most of them were, you know, it was
a couple of directors, a couple of actresses, and so on. But this year, it was notable that, you know, the numbers were down again. And as a programmer, I understand how hard it is to look for films when you're doing an international festival, you know, just to cover the world and to cover the kind of demographics and the ideas and discussions that you want to provoke and invoke in a film festival. So a festival like the Cannes Film Festival has certain limited choices. What I've been finding for us this year is you just have to work a little bit harder. You really do. And I think you have to change the conversation. You have to change the way that you look at films and the way that you look for films. One of the things that I would say about Cannes is that they have a great program called the Ciné Fondation, which is they choose 15 emerging filmmakers from a very, you know, often emerging countries as well, from very broad demographics. And you'd think that that would be a place where they could actually encourage women. But the percentages there have been notably slow, let's say. So that would be a place where I think you could actually invest in emerging filmmakers so that when by the time they sort of graduate to the main competition, there are greater choices to be made.
There just needs to be a submerged category.
Right? Yes.
Pull them out of the muck.
Right.
So, you know, you're privy to what's out there, what's coming right up this season. What are some standouts for you?
In terms of roles for women, I think one of the things that's really noticeable this year is that there are some great women's roles. And quite often around this time of year, people start wondering who's going to be on the awards track. So, you know, that gives a certain cachet and a certain attention to it. One of the films that I saw in Cannes actually was Todd Haynes's film Carol. So directed by a man, but can I say one of the most female-friendly male directors in the world?
Okay.
And Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara are terrific. And it's an adaptation of a book that was written by Patricia Highsmith in the early 50s. It's a lesbian story that has actually a somewhat happy ending. And it's a really, really beautiful film. It's exquisitely made and the performances are terrific. And then in other parts of the landscape, there's like in a different age group, Charlotte Rampling has an exquisite role in a film called 45 Years, which is about a marriage that is hitting its 45th anniversary. And she and Tom Courtney are in that. But one of the things that I'm noticing is that actually there are a lot of great roles for women, but most of them are directed by men. An exception to that would be Suffragette, which is a very anticipated film that's coming out later on this year. That is one of the few that I'm noticing that is actually directed by, written by, and produced by women. And as the title would suggest, it's about the suffragette movement in England in the early 20th century. Carrie Mulligan is the lead character in it. And again, she's probably one of the people who's going to be on the awards track. So although there are a lot of, I think, quite dynamic women's roles out there, the woman director thing is a little bit more, you know, few and far between when you get to this level of work.
Among this list, are there any highlights that you'd want to call out for the upcoming Mill Valley Film Festival?
One of the things that we're excited about is that we're doing a spotlight on Sarah Silverman. Her film was at Sundance, and it's kind of a breakthrough role for her. I Smile Back. Not a comedy role. It's definitely, she's a damaged human being who is coming through it, and she's in front of every breath of the film. So it's a pretty spectacular performance, and I think there's a lot of expectation around that. So, yeah, she'll be there.
This film is going to be, it's a drama.
It's a drama,
and
yeah,
a
absolutely.
Tragedy in a way, right?
Yeah, it's yeah.
The opposite of comedy.
The opposite, yes, exactly.
It's not even dark comedy.
No, it's just dark. It's just dark, yeah.
Well, I'm just wondering about the number of women in film, how that's changing, and whether the industry is starting to see a bit of a business case for it. I read on 538.com, they did a study that shows that when films pass the Bechdel test, the test designed by cartoonist Alison Bechdel that asks whether the film has at least two named women in it who talk to each other about something besides a man. Those are the three criteria, right?
Right.
That these films actually have an equal return on investment
than
those that don't.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think?
I think generally it's true. You know, I mean, as you said, women make up 50% of the the population. They're a significant part of our audience. At film festivals particularly, we have a very high percentage of women who are the ticket buyers, for instance. And the Bechdel test, I think, although it came out of a cartoon from the 80s, is something that seems to have been generating, you know, more and more people know what it is now. And it's a great way of actually elevating the conversation about film. So it's one of the things that we've been using as we've been discussing the films that we're choosing for Mill Valley Film Festival this year. So we've been looking as we go at whether films are directed by women, written by women, you know, if the primary creatives are involved in the creation of the story. But we've also been going through what the stories are about. We've been applying the Bechdel test, and then we've ratcheted that up a little bit, and we've been seeing if films are passing what we've been sort of calling the agency test. Do the female characters have agency? Are they driving the story? Are they active rather than reactive? So essentially, we've been applying three tests. Who are the primary creatives? Does it pass the Bechdel test? And does it pass the agency test?
You have a name for this package of programming.
Mind the gap. Yeah, of course.
Mind the gap.
Yes. As somebody who grew up in Britain, the tube stations are redolent with the phrase mind the gap. So, pun intended, mind the gender gap, because we like to bear it in mind, and we kind of do mind that there's a gap. Yeah, it was a whimsical way of looking at, you know, women working in film this year.
Well, is there any correlation, aside from elevating the conversation, is there any correlation between films that do well at festivals and their success in the mainstream, particularly, you know, when you're looking at male-directed films versus female-directed films? How do they fare after a festival like yours or Sundance?
Right, that's a great question. The films themselves.
Or the directors.
Or the directors, yeah. I mean, the films themselves will often get sort of a stamp of approval by being at a significant film festival. I mean, we find that a lot of distributors want their films at Mill Valley Film Festival. You know, we're not a competitive festival, but they want to say, you know, this is a part of the official selection of Mill Valley Film Festival. But one of the things that I think has been noted with films who go to Sundance, which is a competitive film festival, is that of the people who win the dramatic competitions, it's more likely if you're a man that you'll be offered a high-budget Hollywood film to direct than if you're a woman. So there's a prevalent thinking that's, you know, the old boys club holds still. There are a lot of organizations that have been coming up, like Film Fatale, that are really trying to have women work together, women who are working with narrative filmmaking. Networking is obviously a key thing, and really being a support to each other is a key thing. And I think there's a chapter that's recently started in the San Francisco Bay Area. So,
well, I've
those
read,
things are important. Yeah,
I've read a couple of examples of that. Meryl Streep recently announced her Writers Lab for writers over 40.
Yes,
Or for women over 40 in particular, with the idea that if you have more women in the position of writing, maybe you see more of them in the film represented with agency, if you will. And then Rose Byrne started an all-women Australian production company called the Dollhouse Collective. And it seems like if you've got more women kind of taking control of their own destiny, that might be one more way that more women are elevated who might not already hold that power.
Right. It is about holding the power. It's been intriguing for me as we've been going through the selection process at Mill Valley. This isn't something that programmers necessarily normally do, but we've been tracking how many of the documentaries, how many of the narrative features from America, how many of the world features, how many of our shorts are directed, written, or produced by women. And it was intriguing to me to see that the U.S. was kind of lagging behind in the narrative section, both from the number of films we had just submitted and the number of films that we've been researching. It's actually harder, even at the independent level of American filmmaking, for women to get narrative features made, it seems.
And do you think that is just a matter of financing? Is it? I mean, it certainly can't be talent.
Right.
I mean, I'll just give the benefit of the doubt there.
Right.
So what do you think is happening? What do you think is creating that gap?
Making a film is kind of a phenomenal thing to do for anybody. I mean, you know, there are always stories about people who've completely maxed out their credit cards and gone for every, you know, favor in the book. I think one of the things in the United States is that there's no support governmentally. There, you know, there's very little support for narrative filmmakers who are coming up. I was at a panel in the Berlin Film Festival earlier on this year, and the woman who's the CEO of the Swedish Film Institute completely upped the ante. So the majority of feature filmmaking in Sweden is funded by government funds. So she just took the, I was going to say the bull by the horns, and I should probably say the cow by the tail.
Right.
And said, we are going to give 50% of our funding to women.
Period.
Yep. And it was a very audacious move. And it was an interesting conversation in Berlin that was we had, you know, and some of the American women who were there were saying, well, you know, this is hard to do because we don't get a lot of funding for films in the United States. But there is some funding out there. So it's like if you're getting something from, you know, a foundation, what if the foundations were actually applying the 50% rule?
Well, what about the argument that they still need to be qualified and they still need to have the talent and the idea and the, you know, the story still has to be good and all of that, and so that it's not just about filling a quota.
Right.
It's not just about, oh, I got the film made because I'm a woman.
Right.
You know, so what comes into play there, do you think, if you just set that hard line of 50%?
Right, good question. Well, I'm going to talk from my experience of doing this program this year. I don't feel that in looking to raise the awareness about women filmmakers that we've diminished the quality of the work that we're showing at all. And that's really encouraging. I think, again, from the programmatic point of view, a part of it is how we look at films. You know, because you have to come back to yourself. You have to say, you know, what are my biases? What are the things that stop me from seeing this as a compelling story? Do I need to educate myself? Especially when you're programming an international film festival. I mean, I don't live in Iran. How should I, you know, who am I to judge an Iranian film? I don't live in Peru. It's like you have to try and figure out ways that you can look at work, be open to it, and bottom line, if a film is compelling, it's compelling. So I would say from my experience this year that the stories are out there and women are making them. Are they making them in as great numbers as men? They're not. So how do you make that happen? That's the conundrum.
Well, and you said earlier you just have to work a little bit harder to find them.
For me, yeah, definitely. In approaching this with the notion of raising people's awareness about films, going back to story, I mean, it's so important for any human being to see something of themselves on screen and in the stories that we see. You know, we tell stories so that we can remember the truth. We remember the truth about us, you know, really basic things. We want to be able to see ourselves. So if there are no women that you're seeing, then you've lost 50% of the stories right there. But in terms of storytelling, the notion of agency, of having women characters who are driving rather than being reactive, that kind of thing, that's the awareness I hope that we're going to be able to raise as we launch these films into people's awareness this year.
We're talking with Zoe Elton, the program director for the Mill Valley Film Festival. This year's festival features inspiring women in film. I'm Lauren Schiller. You're listening to Inflection Point. We'll be back right after this. Hi, I'm Lauren Schiller, and I hope you're enjoying Inflection Point. You can show us how much you like us by going to our Facebook page at facebook.com/inflectionpointradio or follow me on Twitter at LA Schiller. Plus, sign up for weekly email updates at inflectionpointradio.org. I'm Lauren Schiller, and you're listening to Inflection Point. My guest is Zoe Elton, the program director for the Mill Valley Film Festival. Well, you mentioned the Sarah Silverman film. What are some other examples of films that we can look forward to seeing at the festival?
Well, let's talk about a local one, Code, Debugging the Gender Gap. Robin Hauser Reynolds' film. She has made a film about coding and girls who do or do not code. It's very compelling. She has a great number of women who are working in technology. And as you probably know, in many industries, technology being one of them, the numbers of women are not really very high.
Yeah.
So that's a really compelling one. We're hoping that we're going to be able to show it with, we're going to do it, include it in, also in a part of our education program so that we start to work with young people with it as well. A film by Maria Cohen, called The Girl in the Book, which is directed by her. It's a first feature. It's a female-driven story about a woman who's working in a literary agency and never quite getting credit for discovering the writers she's discovering. And in doing that, we experience something that happened to her as a younger woman that also appropriates her story. We're showing a film called Women He's Undressed, which is a documentary by Gillian Armstrong, the Australian director. This was kind of cool for us. She's a director whose first feature, My Brilliant Career, great title, you know, was a great title that really stuck for with a lot of women.
Still remember that film.
And I think it was a, you know, sort of seminal film for inspiring women to know that they can follow their dreams. The dream that she's following this time is actually about Ori Kelly, who's a designer at Warner Brothers in the sort of the height of the Hollywood era, also a gay man. So in this, we sort of take the male gaze into a slightly quirky Australian vision of what that looks like. But it's a really, it's a beautifully made documentary.
Well, I did see the trailer for this, and the costumes are absolutely phenomenal that this man put together. And I didn't ever stop to think that there was, you know, I'm not in the industry, I guess, but I just stopped to think that there was someone who was the mastermind behind so many of these films and these gorgeous costumes. You know, we were debating on whether we should pull a clip from this from this trailer, because there's this amazing quote by Jane Fonda, which just makes you question, makes you sort of celebrate women on screen, but also question, you know, how far have we really come? So I want to play that clip, and then we can come back to our conversation.
All his genius was on display in Some Like It Hot. You could not take your eyes off her breasts.
Well, let's switch gears. Zoe, let's talk about you for a minute.
Okay.
How long have you been with the Mill Valley Film Festival?
Since it started, 38 years ago.
What?
I know, I was fresh off the boat from England. What can I say?
you bumped up against Mill Valley and...
Yeah, no, I was just at the point where I was thinking, should I go back to England or should I... You know, I thought I would be here for 1 year and travel around and hitchhike and go to Peru and then go back. And I ended up staying and sort of had a parallel career for a while, working at the film festival, working in theater and doing design for jewelry and a bunch of other things, so...
Did you ever do costume design?
No, but I'm a theater director and writer, so I have an affinity for that kind of thing.
So what did you make of the focus in the film on Betty Davis?
Well, it's, you know, it was a Betty Davis's breasts were a revelation. Not literally, thanks to Ori Kelly. And, you know, I mean... It's interesting because, I mean, it is, you know, I mean, you know, when you sort of go through sort of feminist history and you look at the male gaze, you know, there is that, but...
G-A-Z-E.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Because now, you could interpret that another
Thank
way.
You. Yes. But have things really changed? You know, I mean, we can look back at the golden era of Hollywood and think, oh, yeah, it was so beautiful. It was so divine, you know, and women were treated as goddesses, which in many ways they were. But is it exploitative? Are they gorgeous? You know, do we celebrate the gorgeousness? Well, yes, we do. Do we still do that? Well, yes. But, you know, where else does that take us? So I think there are interesting conversations that can come out of that.
Well, it does seem like an opportunity, too, to just talk about what it means to be a movie star and what you're representing when you're on the screen and the different body types and the different sexualities and the different, you know, choices of where the story is going to go.
Well, and it's an interesting thing for actors, I think, particularly because in a way they're almost like the last person to get the choice. I don't know how actors manage to stay sane. You know, you're always having to go out on auditions. You know, you're always being looked at. You're always being told you're too tall, too short, too fat, too thin, you know, or, you know, you have to change your body shape, your body weight in order to conform to something. And then there's the image thing. You know, why do we always see women as a certain type? Why can't we push the parameters of things? You know, I mean, it's like there's no reason other than a failure of the imagination that you can't see women in roles that are non-traditional.
Well, given all our discussion about this being such a male-dominated field, what has it been like for you to be a woman who has the opportunity to influence what gets featured?
Well, at one level, it's great. We can bring together a phenomenal group of people, I think, to this year's festival. It was interesting, actually, to embark on doing the Mind the Gap program, because initially we said it was going to be like a women's focus. But typically, if you do a focus in a festival, you know, it's half a dozen films at the most, you know, from a geographically defined or, you know, thematically defined. And we realized that what we were doing was something that was quite radical, because it actually crosses the whole festival. So I kind of feel that where I would like to get to is 50%. You know, I see so many other festivals saying, you know, we have 30% women directors here or there. And I feel like people are just playing with numbers. I don't want to just play with numbers. I really want to elevate the conversation. And I would like us to get to the point where we see 50% women directors. We're not there yet, but we can, right?
We can. We definitely can. Well, what's the best advice about running a film festival that you've ever received?
Probably don't.
Is that what you were told 38 years ago?
Well, no, no. When I first got involved in Mill Valley Film Festival, I hadn't even never been to a film festival. And I'd worked in theater. And it, actually, when I started doing the film programming part of it after, you know, several years, it was really shocking to realize that I was spending way more time in curating film than I'd ever done if I was producing some of my own work in theater. You know, and even that is crazy, as I'm sure you know. You know, you're up all hours and all that kind of thing. But, I mean, I haven't had a day off in a couple of weeks, you know. I'm a little sleep deprived. And, yes, it is great to see movies. Sometimes. You know, when you consider about 1 in 10 actually make it into the program, you have to go through a lot of ones before you find the real gems.
Right. Well, after the festival in October, you'll get to sleep a little, right?
I hope so, yeah.
All right. Well, Zoe Elton, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Lauren.
The Mill Valley Film Festival runs from October 8th to 18th in Mill Valley, California. You can find out all about the festival at mvff.com, which stands for Mill Valley Film Festival. That's our inflection point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, listen to previous shows and sign up for our email updates. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/inflectionpointradio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations by PRX. Make sure you listen to our interview with Parker Posey by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller. Thanks for listening. You could find out, why do I feel like I suddenly became an amateur? What just happened? And that better, you better not put that at the end of any show.